Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you deal with animals, PETA has an opinion about you, and you probably have an opinion about PETA. For researchers in medical labs, people for the ethical treatment of animals is a relentless foe. For those who wear fur coats, it is the looming threat of a bucket of red paint. For the factory farm industry, PETA is a mortal enemy and a terrible prick to the conscience. For even some animal lovers, it is the group that goes too far. But for many advocates of animal rights, PETA, for all its over-the-top drama, is the organization daring enough, odd enough, and tenacious enough to make human society change the way it treats and views non-human creatures. This year, PETA marks its 25th anniversary on the front lines of the animal rights movement, on animal liberation, as PETA would say. This hour on Point, we'll talk with Ingrid Newkirk, founder and president of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA. You can join the conversation. Have you followed the evolution of PETA? Are you turned off by their street theater and attention-grabbing tactics, or turned on? Are you prepared to see all animals as essentially off-limits to human will? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Norfolk, Virginia, is Ingrid Newkirk. She started PETA in 1980. The animal rights group now has 850,000 members, maybe more, worldwide. It raises more than $15 million a year. It's been called the most successful radical organization in America. Its mission statement, which it calls abolitionist, reads as follows. Animals are not ours to eat, wear, experiment on, or use for entertainment. That is radical. Ingrid Newkirk, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being with us. How are you feeling on the 25th anniversary of your outrageous organization?
Ask my crow's feet. I'm feeling pretty good that we've come a long way, but of course it's an enormous task because we're out to change people's hearts and minds and behaviors, and nobody likes change. I was in the airport the other day and I saw a Starbucks. There was a little jar there, and it said, if you don't like change, leave yours here. And I thought, that's the story of our lives, trying to get people to change their impression of who animals are.
So here we are. The headlines keep coming on the PETA and animal rights front. I'm looking here just a couple of days ago, well, October, I guess, Anna Wintour, one of your favorite. This is the editor of Vogue, who, of course, Vogue has shows a lot of fur. Another tofu pie in the face. Here's Elle McPherson, who's become the supermodel, the new face of Black Gamma Mink, saying on October 2nd she's trying to get out of a $2.3 million contract to promote fur after receiving threats from animal rights activists. I assume that's your threats, Ingrid Newkirk.
Well, if you'd like to define a letter as a threat, I suppose one could. But we wrote to her and said, Elle, what on earth are you thinking? I know money is important to you, but here's a tape. And, of course, that tape is available for anyone to look at. It's on PETA.org. You can see it. It takes a strong stomach to watch. And it's of all the fur that's coming in nowadays from China and the East, that is from animals who are bludgeoned to death. They're still conscious often when they are skinned. And we said, Elle, look at the footage of this raccoon dog, a particular kind of animal that's commonly used, blinking up through his eyelashes. His eyelashes are all that remain of the hair on his body, the rest having been removed. And he's still looking at the camera. He's still conscious. And we said, Elle, you know, really, you can make money in other ways. You've got investments. You've got other things to model. These days, please stay away. She feared protests, and apparently she feared them to the point where she looked to get out of her contract. And that's fine. That's good.
I wonder how you see the whole PETA mission going. I mean, in a way, Elle McPherson might be one good measure. It was in 1994 that Elle Macpherson, along with other supermodel Cindy Crawford, Christy Turlington, Naomi Campbell, posed nude with the tagline, "I'd rather go naked than wear fur." Now here we are, 2005, and she was signed up to represent mink as their, you know, as the face of Black Gamma Mink. Is that kind of the story of PETA? One step forward, two steps back? Where do you see the line of progress on animal rights in your view, Ingrid Newker?
No, not at all. I think we are steadily making progress. And maybe this will sound catty, but I think that models are known not for long memories, but for long legs. And Naomi Campbell seemed to forget that she had signed that petition that she wouldn't wear fur at a time in her life when she was having a lot of difficulties keeping her contracts and did pretty much anything. So we give up on some people who can't remain strong to their principles. But the fact is that most young people would rather be seen dead than in fur. They don't think it's fashionable. It is something from their grandmother's era. And even though, as you said, Anna Wintour will put it in vogue all day long because it's a paying proposition, even though you see it on the runways, what you see on the runway doesn't convert to what you see on the street. Otherwise, people would have whole foxes on top of their heads and things like that.
Ingrid Newkirk, what does the world look like in a PETA-perfect world? How far would that be from the world we see today? It's hard to imagine. When I look at your mission statement, I mean, it's so sweeping here that we would not, animals are not ours to eat, wear, experiment on, or use for entertainment. There goes most of the protein that Americans consume, I would guess, in any case. There goes leather shoes, I guess. There goes medical research and science on a very large scale. There go circuses and horse races. What would the world look like in Ingrid Newkirk's perfect vision?
Well, I would say that science would certainly improve. And over the 25 years that PETA has been around, we have seen enormous strides in getting away from the use of animals. Even the government, and the government doesn't move for love nor money, it's the slowest to make progress. They have switched the Environmental Protection Agency, particularly, from hideous experiments on animals in many of their tests for environmental toxins to non-animal tests that are quicker, that don't involve the patter of little feet, that give you results that relate to the human condition. And as for the protein business, I mean, look at us. We're a nation of people who make the floorboards wobble when we walk. It's really rather sad that children have hardening of the arteries now when they're only 2 years old. So we've got to get to a vegetarian diet, if not for the animals and not for the fact that it pollutes our environment, just the fact that it's causing us obesity, cancer, heart disease, blood pressure raising, and all these other things that are problems for us.
But is that really meat that's causing that, or piles of Twinkies?
Oh, no, it's meat and dairy, it's fat. You know, if you switch to a vegetarian diet, and anyone who's listening and thinks, well, I'll just give it a whirl, even if it's just for a day or a meal, we'll give them a free vegetarian starter kit. Just it's for the asking. When you switch, you are eating foods. Vegetarian foods have no cholesterol whatsoever. Cholesterol is only found in animal products, milk, ice cream, dairy, meat, chicken, that sort of thing. It has high fiber. Vegetarian foods are full of fiber, and you do need fiber. Meat has no fiber.
Still, we know lots of high medical officials have said that the use of animals, I'm quoting Jocelyn Elders here, former U.S. Surgeon General, use of animals in biomedical research and testing has been and will continue to be absolutely critical to the progress against AIDS and a wide range of other applications in both human and animals. And the PETA kind of reputation is that you elevate animals right up to the human status and maybe even above. You know, the thing said written in jest in The Onion, the sort of humorous online group, they said, heroic PETA commandos kill 49, as in humans, save rabbit. And you're quoted as saying, when it comes to feelings like hunger, pain, and thirst, a rat is a pig, is a dog, is a boy. Is there no distinction you draw between human and animal, Ingrid Newkirk?
Well, first, I adore The Onion, and if I hadn't found animal rights, I'd beg them for a job. But it's a biological fact, isn't it, Tom? I mean, if you just think about it, when it comes to feelings, like hunger, pain, and thirst. A rat is a dog, is a pig, is a boy. We're all mammals. We all have nerves that allow us to experience pain. We all get frightened. There have been innumerable studies, especially in the last year, that have pointed out to us, and they should be more than interesting, they should guide our conduct, that say even fish can feel pain, even their mouths are sensitive, that when a laboratory door opens, rats and mice, their adrenaline level soars, their hearts pound, they are nervous because they know something is going to happen to them. So if we recognize that animals aren't widgets, they're not boards of wood, they are actually thinking, feeling, anticipating beings like us, who if you burn them with a cigarette, they'll scream, or at least they'll feel pain, then we have to be sure that we are not just treating them as if they're disposable commodities. We've done that through history with human beings. We've disrespected the disabled, people of color, orphans, women, and now we need to remember that animals are also thinking, feeling beings. They may not be exactly like us physically, but they do feel, and they do think, and they do feel scared, and they do value their little lives.
Should their rights be equal to human rights?
Well, they don't need to drive a car or vote, although I'm not sure they couldn't do a better job of us at voting. But they do need to be respected for the things that are important. And I think perhaps it's easy to understand if you think of a bird. A bird has wings. A bird is obviously meant to fly. Therefore, taking a bird, sticking them in a cage, depriving them of flight for life, and using them as a living decoration in your living room or in a hotel foyer, is something wrong with that, you know.
We hear it. We want to come back and hear about your story, Ingrid Newkirk, how you got neck deep in all of this. We're glad you're with us. It's fascinating. Listeners, we're talking with Ingrid Newkirk. She's co-founder and president of PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. You can join us. Have you followed the paint-throwing, fur-bashing, high-drama, naked protests of PETA? Are you drawn to PETA's radical street theater or turned off by it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with Ingrid Newkirk, co-founder of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, the guerrilla liberationists of the animal rights movement, and you've followed their deadly serious hijinks for a long time. They've crawled through the streets of Paris with leg-hold traps around their feet, dumped buckets of money soaked in fake blood on audiences at the International Fur Fair, compared the deaths of women murdered and dismembered by serial killers to those of animals killed for meat. They've compared factory farming to slavery and the Holocaust. What do you think? Do you believe humans have a right to impose themselves in any way, in some way, on animals? And when PETA compares our treatment of animals to slavery and the Holocaust, does that bring you epiphany or revulsion? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ingrid Newkirk, I wish you'd share your story with us. Where did you come from, and how did you get mixed up in this?
Well, I was a carnivore's carnivore, I suppose. I also had my first fur coat when I was 19. I'm now 56 and a half, and there weren't any animal rights activists when I had my fur to come up to me and say something.
You grew up in India, educated in convents, as I read here.
Well, first in England, and then in France a little bit, then we moved to India. And, of course, in India, you do see cruelty on the streets in front of you. There are starving dogs. There are beasts of burden pulling carts with bricks. But in my mind, as I grew up, I always thought the West was this civilized place where animals were treated with respect. Saying that, my father and I think, were eating our way through the animal kingdom because he loved calves' brains on toast and raw oysters and what have you. But we always took in stray animals, and we just never made the connection that we were hurting other animals. Mm. But one day, I was a law enforcement officer in Maryland. I answered a case call about a farm that had been abandoned. I found all these animals who had died except one little pig. Mm. this little pig was still alive. I carried him outside in my arms, had to hold his head up because he was so weak, and give him some water. He made these little grunting sounds of gratitude or whatever they were. My job as a law enforcement officer was to prosecute the people who had hurt that pig and the others who had died. Mm. But on the way home that night, I was thinking, I wonder what I've got to eat. I was very hungry, and I was thinking, oh, yes, I've defrosted those pork chops. Mm. And suddenly, of course, the penny dropped, and I thought, here I am. I'm going to prosecute people for cruelty to one pig, and I'm actually paying someone that I can't see to be cruel, because we all know slaughterhouses aren't pleasant places, to another pig in another place. So I just made the connection and thought, I don't know what I'm going to eat, but I'm not going to eat animals anymore. And it was sort of an evolution, as it is for most of us, from there. If we care about animals, we learn more and more.
And you describe also the time when you took, a dozen kittens to the animal shelter, turned around, and to your surprise, they weren't put in pens. They were almost immediately killed.
They were, and I didn't understand then, as I think many people don't, that there is this enormous, and still is, enormous overpopulation crisis where people go to the pet shop, they go to the breeder, they decide they want a purebred dog or kitten, and they are contributing to the fact that we have millions of animals with no homes. They are literally dying for a home, sitting on death row in your local pound or shelter. There is this thing called a no-kill movement that started now, but it really doesn't solve the problem, because those no-kill shelters only take in the few that they can place, or they take in ones to just stay there for the rest of their lives and then close the door on the rest. Mm. And these suburban and municipal shelters, and anyone who has the guts to do it, is still out there taking in the unwanted, aggressive, pregnant, sick, and not able to find homes for them, ends up having to put them down.
25 years is a long time. I wish you'd walk us through two lists, at least the highlights. On the one hand, PETA's become famous for its outrageous kind of guerrilla theater around animal rights, animal liberation. On the other hand, it does have a record of getting results. First, on the street theater side, take us through some of the more outré examples of PETA drama. How high have you set the bar? How outrageous have you been on behalf of animals?
Well, it's funny, Tom, because there is this urban myth that we throw paint on people, and we actually have never done it. The closest you might come is we constantly get onto runways at fashion shows, and one of our gimmicks is to hold up our blood-painted hands, but they're our own hands, and say you have blood on your hands if you have fur on your back. I think this was perpetuated when Joan Rivers was walking down a street in Manhattan, and someone apparently spritzed her coat, her fur coat, with paint. Mm. She went on all the national shows saying, oh, it's those PETA people. Joan is now a friend of ours. Her daughter actually appeared in I'd Rather Go Naked Than Wear Fur for Us, and her mother is very proud of her.
But aren't those PETA people, whether they are formally or not, isn't that the PETA impulse? Spray the paint on the fur, do what it takes to get people's attention, make them angry, get them upset, maybe change them.
Well, Tom, no, if you read anything I've ever written or go to PETA.org, anyone can see that throughout our history we have never, ever espoused that. What we say is, don't ever let anyone who's wearing fur, even a collar or a cuff, pass you by without saying something. But that can be polite. You can say, you look so beautiful. Why are you ruining that look with these slaughtered animal skins? You could say, shame, you shouldn't be wearing fur. You know you shouldn't.
I can't believe
you. Or you can hand them a card.
But you're giving us a kind of knitting circle, quilting the vision of PETA. I mean, your people have been out there and pretty brazen, and you've been proud of it.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yes. I'm just simply correcting the record that we've never thrown or advocated throwing paint on anyone. I don't particularly mind that that's the myth. We do the naked demonstrations. We've done sit-ins. We've jumped on the runway. all sorts of things that are gimmicky and perhaps colorful and even sexy. Because today, as everyone knows, if they read the paper or turn on TV or the radio, most shows require some degree of titillation or scandal or confrontation. But that gimmickry is something we're sort of compelled to do, because if we don't, no one will pay any attention. And then the animal side of the story, which is pretty grotesque and must be paid attention to, won't get any attention.
Now, I know you've gotten individuals' attention, especially stars who you tend to go after when they become associated with fur. There was the incident of Ben Affleck buying, was it J-Lo, a chinchilla
yes.
coat. You guys were on him, and he was apologizing and becoming a PETA member in about 5 seconds. beyond the individuals and the stars that you target, what do you claim credit for in terms of policy changes in whatever arena for your campaigns?
Well, I'm so pleased. This doesn't usually involve gimmickry, although it did when Al Gore was campaigning for president. Wouldn't listen to us at all. We have so many scientists, medical people trying to say, look, he was in charge of the EPA then. Will you please put non-animal tests in place of these old crude animal tests? He wouldn't listen at all. We followed him around in a bunny suit, which really embarrassed him because all the press kept saying, look, there's the bunny hopping after Al Gore. So finally he met with us and our scientists, and we did save about 800,000 animal lives and during that campaign because of that. We have stopped all car crash tests on animals. If you turn on the television and you see a mannequin being slammed into a wall, you probably don't realize that before we came along and campaigned, those were pigs and baboons being slammed into those walls. Mm. General Motors was the last company to change, and we changed them. We've made massive changes, not that it's pretty and not that it's kind in factory farming, but massive changes with McDonald's, with Wendy's, with Burger King, with Safeway, about unannounced inspections of their slaughterhouses, with giving
animals. Are you saying those are all
room.
up to your standard now? McDonald's, Wendy's, Safeway, they're all like PETA certified, up and down?
Not at all, although we, of course, promote the BK veggie, which gets us some criticism because Burger King sells meat. And any animals who are used in factory farming are castrated without anesthesia still. You know, they're dehorned, they're de-beaked without even an aspirin. So, no, it's not up to PETA standards. We'd rather everyone went vegetarian or vegan. But we have our feet on the ground, our heads in the air, perhaps in the clouds. But we do say, if you come along, if you make steps, all kindnesses are good things. And we will back off, as we did with Burger King, as we did with McDonald's, when they made significant changes.
Even though it's shy of your perfect world.
We'll never have a perfect world. You know, all of us would like peace on Earth. And what is it, 37 wars being fought against other human beings around the globe at any given time?
Ingrid Newkirk, are you mellowing on your 25th anniversary here?
No, I'm still upset at the enormity of animal abuse. I'm upset at the complacency of many human beings. But I'm encouraged at young people who are driving the animal rights movement the way they drove the environmental movement, teaching their parents the way they taught them to recycle. They're teaching them how to buy silk instead of milk and those kinds of things. So, no, I am the same me as 25 years ago, and we are still pragmatic.
I want to turn for just a moment to Washington, D.C. Wayne Pacelli is joining us. He's president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States. Called the nation's largest animal protection organization. Wayne, thank you very much for joining us.
Happy to be listening in on this nice conversation.
We're spending an hour with Ingrid Newkirk. You know PETA's reputation. You know the kind of stunts and hijinks and great big comparisons they're willing to make on behalf of animals. You're a little more mainstream, I guess, than PETA. So how do you see them? Do they improve the odds for animal welfare in your view, or do they sour the well?
Well, I think, you know, if you take an historical look, you would just have to say that PETA has had a major, major impact on thinking about animals in this country. And I think Ingrid is absolutely right. They have they've really pushed corporations in a major way. I don't think that any group has had a bigger impact on corporate behavior in terms of their dealings with animals. And I think that PETA deserves that sort of credit. And I think the media caricature PETA, and I think PETA sometimes, and Ingrid would probably agree to this, caricatures itself in order to draw attention. And I think that PETA's view is that inattention is the biggest impediment to change. And PETA thinks that provoking a discussion sometimes helps, even if they get some mud on their face. And sometimes it bleeds over, and the perception is that you know, all animal activists do throw paint on people's fur coats or take things too far. And that would be the criticism that's thrown back at PETA. But there's just no doubt that PETA has really helped advance the discussion the last 25 years. And, you know, we have a program called the Genesis Awards in Los Angeles, and we recognize the major media for doing exceptional stories about animals. And we started it 20 years ago. And when it started, there were just a handful of categories. There were a few stories in each category that were nominated.
Yeah.
Now we have 25 categories. We have an abundance of nominations in each category. So the discussion is being advanced in a very measurable way, and I think that PETA really deserves credit for much of that.
And some concrete steps here as well. I see a news story just out from your organization saying Trader Joe's, under your pressure, has agreed to improve its hen welfare policy, that its chickens, its hens, won't be in battery cages, these tight little cages where they can't spread their wings as they're laying eggs anymore. I guess all part of the same trend you're describing.
Well, the Humane Society of the U.S. announced the No Battery Cage campaign earlier this year, and since we announced it, Whole Foods, Wild Oats, and now Trader Joe's, along with all sorts of college campuses, Bon Appetit, which is a major food service provider, have all moved in our direction. So, you know, and I just yesterday testified in the U.S. Senate on a bill dealing with puppy mills, and just last week the Congress banned horse slaughter. About 90,000 horses are shipped to slaughterhouses.
And banned it at least for a while, as I understand, not permanently yet.
Not permanently, but we are. That was a one-year spending bill, but it showed where the Congress's heart is on this issue.
But let me ask you, Wayne Pacelli, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but our time is short. PETA champions animal liberation. Your group works more in terms, as I understand, of animal welfare. Is there a difference? Are you willing to ready to go all the way to follow the PETA mission statement? No food, don't eat them, don't wear them, don't use them. Period. Or is that beyond what you push for?
We have a different tactical approach, and I think some different philosophies. We share an approach on fur. Both organizations agree that wearing the skins and pelts of animals in this day and age is not necessary, and it is demonstrably inhumane. We agree on elephants and circuses, that they shouldn't be in those performances, and we agree on a lot. The areas where we would have some policy differences might be on the animal agriculture issues, where PETA would be more abolitionist. We do think vegetarianism is an excellent option, but we also urge people to reduce their consumption, and we also work to refine techniques. But frankly, you know, PETA's campaigns against Wendy's and Burger King were also refinement campaigns. We're also not as abolitionist on the animal research front. Sometimes we work more closely with companies. So I would say we have a different approach. I think any social movement, whether it's civil rights or women's rights or gun rights or any, you know, abortion rights or pro-life, there are various strains of thought, and there are different organizations that play different roles. And we play a different role at the Humane Society of the U.S. than PETA does, but I can also recognize the historical contributions that a group like PETA has made.
Wayne Pacelli, we hear the tip of the hat to Ingrid Newkirk, and we appreciate your time. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Ingrid, what do you think? Do you wish these other organizations would get fully on board and become liberationist? Is that too much to hope for? Do you see yourself as the icebreaker out there asking for complete abolition of animal slavery, I guess you'd call it?
We are the envelope pushers, there's no question. And I think, as Wayne said, we're willing to have mud on our face. Someone has to say the ultimate goal is to stop seeing animals as commodities at all and see them as fellow travelers on the earth. As we are animals, they are animals, we should all be in this together, and stop the bias and the discrimination against them that leads us to exploit and hurt them. But I do believe that in any social movement, as Wayne said, there are so many spokes in the wheel. And it usually means that people don't go from A to Z. They make incremental changes. But you have to, our job is to keep the vision in front of them that perhaps there's a bigger picture, that animals are not ours and that we must treat them with respect because they are so worthy of it if we come to know their characteristics, their behaviors, their maternal love, even their altruism, that one animal will help another and an animal of a different species will rescue a child, for example. We need to remember they're not things.
We're talking with Ingrid Newkirk, co-founder of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA. PETA turns 25 this year. Their mission statement, well, it's a bold one. Animals are not ours to eat, wear, experiment on, or use for entertainment. You can join our conversation. What's your response to the high-profile life's mission of Ingrid Newkirk and PETA? Can you imagine a world that would satisfy Ingrid Newkirk? Is an animal's life equal in value to a human's? We're at 1-800-423-8255, and we will turn to your calls. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Ingrid Newkirk, co-founder of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA. It's their 25th anniversary this year. They are the guerrilla liberationists of the animal rights movement. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ricardo is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Ricardo. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a researcher here in Cambridge, and I'm a vegetarian and believe in the ethical treatment of animals. However, when it comes to our species and furthering our species, every single animal in the world puts its species first than any other. So when it comes to medical research, which would put our species first. And it is absolutely necessary to experiment on an animal, and this is done ethically without any pain to the animal. Why is that wrong? And I'd like to hear what PETA feels about that subject.
Ricardo, I'll put that to Ingrid Newkirk. Let me ask you first. We've heard Ingrid Newkirk already say in this hour there are alternatives to experimenting on animals. I've quoted a couple of prominent people saying not entirely true. What's your view of that? Could we do it without animal experimentation?
Not absolutely. Unfortunately, biology is so complex that you can build a computer model or anything so sophisticated that could replicate what biology does. And unfortunately, the only system that we can use is animals, at least for the next couple hundred years.
Let us pick that up, Ricardo. Ingrid Newkirk, how about it? He says all species put themselves first. Why not humans? And would you really put a human child at risk to save the discomfort of an animal in medical experimentation?
I think we are putting human children at risk by clinging to something that is from a couple of hundred years ago and not letting go of it and letting what we've learned from technology. You can now program high-speed computers, which boggle the mind with their speed, with human data. Ricardo said a number of things, like biology is so complex. Yes, it is. And we are not able to study accurately the human condition in a different species. If you think about just the most commonly used animal in the laboratory, it's the rat or the mouse, rodents. And they are not, they don't breathe in the same way. They don't metabolize drugs at the same speed and in the same way. Their physiology is extraordinarily different from ours.
And yet it's had a high utility. C. Everett Koop, former U.S. Surgeon General, says there is no substitute for animal testing if we're to ensure the safety of consumer products, from personal care to health care and prescription drugs, period.
it makes you weep. I mean, C. Everett Koop, I'm so sorry to say, of course, used to round up his neighbor's cats. It's in his autobiography, and experiment on them in his basement, and he probably would have defended that. He certainly didn't feel chagrined or embarrassed enough about it, or mortified or upset that he left it out of his biography. But the fact is that there's a lot of knee-jerk response to this, but there are millions upon millions of animals used every single year in this country alone, not in life-saving experiments, but to test cigarettes, alcohol, cocaine, all manner of things, when we do have absolutely wonderful physicians and scientists who are crying out for money, who want a slice of that research pie, and who would move human health further, faster, if the animal experimenters would just all please go home, because they are holding back progress. And I'll just give you one example. Mm. There are countless. We used to burn pigs and dogs, and in fact, in some cases, we still do, in burn experiments. We had a terrible record of how many people we could save after severe burns. The breakthrough was when we started to clone human skin. You can now Federal Express a swath of human skin that's been cloned from one hospital to another.
So that's great, but I get the breakthrough. But let me ask you that, in the interim, as we work toward breakthrough, like that, are you willing to sacrifice human life for animal comfort, animal life, in the interim?
It doesn't work that way, Tom, because let me make the point about the human skin is that if we had freed up the money from animal experiments, from all these blowtorch experiments on pigs, and put it into human cloning, we would have been able to save more human lives quicker. It's these animal experimenters, what I call the Joe Sixpack scientists, who haven't moved into the 21st century, who are holding back things that we need to move forward. We don't have cures for HIV, AIDS, any of that that has come from animals. We don't have cures for spina bifida or diabetes that have come from animals. But if you look at, for example, insulin, which used to come from pigs, it caused all these allergic reactions. It wasn't a cure. Now we have Humulin and we have non-animal-based drugs, and they are much, much superior.
I can hear the voices of any number of scientists who might not call themselves Joe Sixpack scientists, but we've got a lot of issues to touch on. Let me go to another call. Dixon's calling from Littleton, Massachusetts. Hi, Dixon. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your show.
Thanks so much.
I'm a dressage trainer. I've been a horseman for my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I'd fall into the category of using animals for entertainment. And it occasionally troubles me for reasons that Ingrid's been raising. And I wonder about things. I've been moving in a vegetarian direction for some time. I consider myself a real animal lover. And I feel strongly that the animals that I work with are better off because I've worked with them.
Do you, when you say you're troubled, do you think you're tormenting horses by working so closely with them to work out what is essentially an entertainment?
Not at all. Not at all. I think, of course, there's some anthropomorphism involved, but it's my conviction that the horses become better, happier, just really thrive in the work that I do with them. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah, let us put that. Ingrid Newkirk, how about it? I mean, humans and animals have had very intimate kind of relationships. For example, equine dressage that Dixon's talking about. For centuries, my own experience, you know, growing up on a farm, I saw lots of what seemed to me very warm and mutually satisfying interaction between animals and humans. Do you just really discount that?
Oh, well, of course, there are mutually rewarding relationships between animals in captivity, just as there were with slaves in captivity. But there is a word that's recently, I read in the New Scientist, it's called anthropodenial rather than anthropomorphism. Anthropomorphism says that we're taking, of course, human traits and attributing them to animals. They're not human traits. Anthropodenial says we're denying the fact that they're shared traits. We all share the desire to be free. That elephant in the circus with the chain about her foot, who can only sway from side to side behind the big top, wants to be free. And yes, I'm sure, Dixon, I'm sure you don't starve or beat your horses. I guarantee you don't. But if you've ever been to see the wonderful Spanish stallions doing their dressage, if you look at them and you see how tight the bit is, how controlled and how boring and repetitious their lives are, and how they have to be disciplined and learn this stuff that has no meaning in horse world, in horse life, when horses are herd animals, when you see them running free on the plains or even together with one other horse in a paddock, there is such joy. What we do is we think, ah, yes, but they're ours and they have no right to enjoy their lives in nature. And so we control them and we put them to our own use, dressage, the circus, in all manner of ways where really they don't need us, they don't want us, and we can find something else to do.
Let us hear from the horse trainer. Dixon, are you a monster with horses on your hands?
No, I'm not. I feel that there's a wonderful statement that the horse discovers themselves through our will. We discover ourselves through their strength. And, you know, it's just, I disagree entirely, and I doubt that Ingrid has ever sat on a dressage horse. And I have seen horses running free, and I've also seen them running free after I've worked with them. And there's no doubt in my mind that they move better, that they're just more expressive. They are, before I work with them, they're basically animals. After I work with them, they've made a movement towards being a dancer or an artist.
Ingrid Newkirk, we hear you gasping there, and yet, horses and humans have been intertwined for eons. Is it not possible that through all that time and all that breeding that there is a mutually rewarding relationship? Do you see them all, horses, as essentially wild creatures at heart, always encumbered or enslaved, your word, by humans when they're in that kind of dressage, let's say?
Well, Tom, there are far worse cruelties, of course, than the slaughterhouses we discussed and having electrodes put in your brain in a laboratory or something. And certainly, animals in captivity are usually bored out of their minds, so giving them something to do can be worthwhile for them. With that, I'm with Dixon. But I do think that there's this idea, oh, they were just animals until I taught them something that appealed to me, is so supremacist. It is the old idea of the Christians going into Africa and making the Africans into something. Before that, they were just savages. And we went there and we imposed our will on them. So, yes, I see the absolute analogy that we are so blinded by our own might and our own interests and our behaviors, what appeals to us, that we manage somehow to block out what, as thinking people, we should be able to clearly learn from the reports that we read in the daily paper, that these animals have expressions of themselves which are important to them and lives and relationships that are important to them. They are not ours. They should not be ours.
Dixon, there's a lot for all of us to meditate on. We wish you and your horse as well. Ingrid Newkirk, you used the word slavery there, and I think you've got a PETA campaign going on right now that compares slaves to animals in the factory farm system. I'm reading here, you have panels in this photographic exhibit, a 1930s photograph of the lynching of a black man in Indiana set against a photograph of an Angus cow hanging by its feet at a slaughterhouse. In a couple of years ago, you had your Holocaust campaign, Holocaust on Your Plate campaign. You're quoted saying, 6 million Jews died in concentration camps, but 6 billion broiler chickens will die this year in slaughterhouses. There again, the equation of human life and animal life so close. You know there were fierce pushbacks to both of those campaigns. Do you still stand by them?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Martin Luther King said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And one of our sponsors of the Animal Liberation Project, which you can see on our website, is Dick Gregory, who is one of the finest civil rights campaigners of all time. He likens it to slavery because it is slavery. There's nothing in the definition of slavery that says it has to happen to a human being. When we have power, isn't the test not to be the biggest bully on the face of the earth or to value our suffering over all other suffering, but to be able to be magnanimous and kind and to look with this huge compassionate eye at what the others who are presently disenfranchised from society are experiencing. Tom, I was in Cincinnati on my book tour, and someone had the decency to take me to the Underground Railroad Museum. It's absolutely wonderful. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that broke my heart, aside from the terrible photographs of what was done to people in this country not that long ago, was that busloads of school children were coming through the exhibit, learning about history, and walking out of the door thinking something horrible happened in our past. The challenge is to see what are we doing that's discriminatory, exploitive, disrespectful today, and how are we engaged in that, and how can we stop it?
Let's take another call. Melissa's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Melissa. You're on the air.
Hi. I guess my comment is actually going along with what you're talking about. I used to be a PETA supporter, meaning monetary donations, and I've stopped because I'm very concerned about the sort of use of women's bodies in the campaigns while we're trying to save animal bodies. And I
you mean the nude supermodels, the I'd rather go naked than wear fur campaign?
Yeah, there's a lot of campaigns like that. And if you look on the website, I was sort of most appalled by the posters they had that sort of had naked women lying prostrate and things like that. And I've been vegetarian for a long time, and I agree with PETA's philosophy, but I just can't support them because of these campaigns.
I understand.
Are you exploiting human women's bodies to save animals, Ingrid Newkirk?
Well, I understand what Melissa means, but no, I don't believe so, and I'll tell you why. Because I think that as a woman, everything I have, my voice, my body, is a political instrument. And if I want to use it in a cause, I have the right to do that. None of these people has been paid. Every single one has said, I want to do this. And in a way, I find that, and I'm an avid feminist, but our feminism has crossed over the line into repression. We are not Afghanistan, where women have to wear a burqa. If women want to take off some of their clothes or all of their clothes to make a statement or just for sexual reasons, let them go ahead. And that's what we believe.
Ingrid Newkirk,
I'm 57 and almost 57, and I've taken off my clothes, so you can't say it's exactly a sex object. And I may again. I'm currently on an auction on eBay, and the winner can have me for a day do anything pretty much. And somebody has suggested they'll make me walk naked through Manhattan carrying a placard. And I said, I will do it.
We don't doubt you for a moment. Our time is so short. Human torture is on the front pages of newspapers around the world lately, and human torture by Americans. Does it make you feel odd to be putting so much emphasis on animals when human torture is on the front page in the headlines?
I believe it's part and parcel of the same thing. You know, if you look at these school shooters, without exception, they started with animals. We actually have a program for prosecutors and judges and juvenile offender relationship people that points out if you don't stop cruelty to animals, it can be a training ground, almost a proving ground for people, as it was with Jeffrey Dahmer, to go and do other things. And I will bet you anything that the people involved in Abu Ghraib, the horrors in these places in Guantanamo.
And I guess the car bombers shouldn't be left out either.
Yeah, they must have a very limited amount of sensitivity. And our challenge is not to be afraid of sensitivity and feelings, not to mask our emotions, but to know when your heart tells you something is wrong and you have power over another, no matter who that other is, you should reach out to them and look after them and protect them.
Ingrid Newkirk, thank you very much for your time today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Ingrid Newkirk, co-founder and president of PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Her new book is Making Kind Choices, Everyday Ways to Enhance Your Life Through Earth and Animal-Friendly Living. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amada, Stefano Cazzones, Matt Lieber, Mary Moore, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman. Our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.